Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2012. Lecture 1, delivered on August 20, 2012. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. Finance, contrary to what the textbook tells you, is a subdiscipline of economics. I would say that it is the economics of money, but there is so much more to finance than just money. As a matter of fact, the whole concept of money is rather difficult to work with once you start trying to pin down a definition of money. But anyway, the textbook says that finance is a combination of economics and accounting. It is not. In this course, we will use financial statements that are generated by accountants, but I will always be cautioning you that these are just looking through a window darkly at a company. And there are ways that we can adjust financial statements produced by accountants, but we cannot rely on them entirely. Finance is as much critical thinking as it is mathematics. We do math in here, and I promise you I'll try to make the math as straightforward as possible. Step one, step two, step three. Sometimes it's not that easy. But we have to do critical thinking in here in this class. Specifically, we want you to think your way through problems that a company faces in the real world. And part of that, a huge part of that, is looking at the larger economic environment in which these companies are functioning, and also looking at the internal dynamics of the company, what its risk preferences are, what its ability to raise capital from different resources is. And also at the end of the day, we have to stop and step back and say, let's do a reality check. What are we doing here? We're not philosophers. Well, unless we're really drunk, then we philosophize. But the point is, we do have to think critically. Here's the bottom line. I'll try to get in this course to the point where you know what I mean by a credit derivative swap. It's a type of security. It's a hybrid. It is an invention. They were bought and sold, created out of nowhere, out of virtually nothing, in some cases actually nothing. They traded in an unregulated market that began in the 1990s. Went bananas in the first decade of the current century. And they nearly destroyed the financial system of the world. We came in 2008 on a very quiet, what started as a very quiet day in mid-September. We came within 2 hours of the entire financial system of the world collapsing. That means everything everyone had in a bank anywhere in the world would have gone away. It would have meant your paycheck, your savings, everything that any institution, any person put in a bank would have been challenged for liquidity, probably would have been worthless. 2 hours. We came within that. 2 hours. Because these hotheads working with these credit derivative swaps had built up such an overhang of this toxic paper that had no asset backing, really, no value in real life terms, to the tune of a staggering amount of money, most of which is still out there, rotting. It's slowing down the global economic system. It will send us into panics that will that the governments and the central banks will try their best to cover so that no one goes crazy and runs through the streets screaming and all that, but it will keep happening. It will slow down economic growth in countries. Some countries will literally go bankrupt over and over again because no one has the courage to face the fact that as far as the notional value of those toxic credit derivative swaps goes, we're talking about a number around $63 trillion. It is dead, worthless paper spinning around in the global economy, and it is dragging down the prospects for growth. In the year 2000, I would have talked to you about the pay down of the national debt, how we were running budget surpluses, the stock market was roaring, we were on the verge of incredible things. We could have made Social Security strong for another century, more than a century. We were going to talk about building space stations and creating unbelievable new energy resources from microwave satellites in the sky collecting sunlight to giant wind turbine fields that would cover literally thousands of acres at a time, government programs to make universities have cheap tuition. We were talking about all of that. Now we're talking about survival. Okay? That's what's at stake in the financial world. I don't need to talk to you about ethics. You are the product of ethics gone wrong. So that's why when I teach you, you know that I will be watching you for the rest of your life. If you do something wrong, I will find you and I will kick your ass. Finance has three different sub-disciplines to it. Or I should say three career paths. Maybe I should put it that way. Career paths. There's financial management, and that's where we're going to spend a lot of time in this course, talking about the internal corporate decision-making mechanism. The big questions in life. What if? How much? Who farted? Never mind that third. These are the questions of whether a project is a go or a no-go. Does the expected future cash flow warrant the cost now of bringing the project online? The answer for this class, you will see how we get the answer in this class. There are more sophisticated methods that are more new age that are being used in out there in some companies now, and I teach that if you want to take the capstone course in finance, FIL 349. But for the most part, you're going to see how it's done out there in companies. They use mostly net present value analysis and or internal rate of return, something like that. And they say, okay, project go, project no go. It's just up or down based upon whether the present value of the future expected cash flows is better than the cost that we're going to spend in the here and now to get the project going. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no, and feelings are hurt sometimes when we say no. And all we can say is, you know, look, you know, bite me. No, we don't say it like that. That just gets them to write bad things about us in reviews. Okay, financial management. The next part of finance that we could talk about a break off would be institutions and markets. This is more like, you would think this is inside of a company, decision making on financing projects, on what projects to take on, that kind of stuff. The institutions and markets, which I will talk about in the first part of the course, rather a little more in depth in the next couple of lectures, has to do with the intermediaries and the financial intermediation itself. Banks, savings and loans, government resources, investment clubs, all those different things that move money from those who have it to those who need it based upon some criteria. That's the second part. Now, the third part of finance is what most people think about when they hear about finance. It's investments. Prices, value, stocks, bonds, trading, risk and return, portfolios, and we'll talk about that in this class too. I'm going to give you a taste of the three major areas. There's actually a couple of other things that are out there too. Just for the purpose of, even if you're not majoring in finance, you're going to deal with finance people. We are assholes, okay? I warn you about that. I want you to know why we do what we do. When you come to us with your project plans and say, well, this is the greatest project since sliced bread. And I say, no. Well, why not? Because it costs more than you're going to get in the future. But the future is wide open. How can you say that? Because I am the finance person. That means that I speak directly to God. They don't buy it, but, you know, again, you answer, bite me. Institutions and markets. You're going to go in your personal lives to banks. You're going to deal with institutions that handle money, your money, other people's money. So you're going to need to know about these institutions and these markets where these institutions get the products that they offer you for your savings and all that, and also the places where you go to get money. Why they do the decision-making they do, and in this course you're going to find out even how to calculate a payment based upon what you want to borrow from a bank or something like that. Investments. This is the place where we get into, again, stocks and bonds, prices, pricing, and all of the different types of considerations we have to make when we go into the world of putting money into the risky stock markets or into the somewhat safer bond markets. So there you go. That's where we start this. I mentioned a term here, financial intermediation. First things first. Woman, do you have $100 I can borrow? No. Yes, you do. No, you probably don't. But look, I forgot your students are paying the tuition here. Like I'm seeing much of. Here we go. If I were to, you know, look for some money, you know, $20, you could lend it. So I might need $20. Someone might be able to lend me $20. In a case like that where someone had a $20 bill in his or her pocket and I needed a $20 bill, we could describe the person with the $20 as a surplus economic agent. And the person who needs the money as a deficit economic agent. Now, in very small money terms, we could probably find each other on Craigslist, in a dark alley, something like that. But when we get up to larger amounts of money, there has to be a mechanism that finds those who need money and matches those that need with those who have money. That process of matching surplus and deficit economic units is called financial intermediation. It's a two-way street. Think, for example, about a bank. The bank is the financial intermediary that finds money from investors and then matches that with those companies and people who need money. That's one half of the flow. But then the other half is seeing to it that the payoff comes. That once the surplus money has flowed to the deficit unit through the financial intermediary, the other side of it comes around and the financial intermediary, or some proxy for that intermediary, sees to it that the money returns in some way. Okay, here's the deal. You see this? The problem is, okay, you have a $500,000 you can lend me. Okay, fine. How about $5? Okay, whoa. You see, here's one of the first things that the intermediary has to do. The intermediary has to look at the level or amount. The level or the amount. There are some investors who would like to lend $100, $1,000, and there are some borrowers who would like to borrow $100 or $1,000. But there are some borrowers who might need $10 million. There is no way that that person who lends $1,000 is going to be the right kind of person to lend that huge amount of money. So the intermediary has to match not just deficit and surplus units, but to match based upon the size of the available and the needed. Second, did you lend me $10?
Sure.
Okay, good. I'll pay you back in 20 years. But suddenly you looked, wait, what? Timing. See, some investors want to lend short. Some investors want to lend long. You'd have an investor who would, you have giant piles of investors who want to lend on the basis of how car loans work, 4 to 6 year. And then you have borrowers who want that. But then there are investors who want to lend only short term. And they would not be appropriate for those who want to borrow long. Similarly, there are some lenders who want to lend long, very, very long. They don't want to lend to someone who's going to pay it off in a month or a year or 5 years. They want someone who's going to pay it off in 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, 500 years. Think, who would want money in 100 years or in 50 years? Try an insurance company. I'm going to tell you a secret here. You're going to die someday. It will hurt like hell. You'll bitch and you'll fuss, and finally you'll shut your mouth and be dead. And we can all go on, remembering you fondly, of course. Sorry, this is really sucking. Here's the deal, though. You see, if I'm getting payments from you, your life insurance payments, I don't want to lend those to someone who's going to pay me back in a year. Actuarially, you're going to live 80, 90 years. You'll live longer than I will, which really pisses me off. Women live longer than men. You know what? Oh, okay. Anyway, but the thing, though, is that insurance company's not going to want that money back right away. It's going to want to lend long because actuarially it will have to satisfy its obligations long in the future. It doesn't want money coming back to it right now. 100 years, well, that's more than a human lifetime. What the heck is that all about? That is all about the disasters that have extraordinary severity but incredibly small frequency. Any of you know what the New Madrid Fault is? Any of you ever heard of it? There is a major fault line running right through this part of the country. It almost never goes. The last time it let loose was in the early 1800s. But when it did, the descriptions, which were quite literate and quite vivid, described something that was like the end of the world. Across Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, Missouri, describing a scene that was like in another world. It was so violent, the earthquake was, that the explorers and settlers described the Mississippi flowing backwards. It actually didn't flow backwards. The force of the upheaval of the earth was so powerful that it threw the water forward back up the Mississippi River, and then it came back down like a tidal wave, increasing the horror of what had happened. We had a kill rate that is estimated, numbers were bad back then, kill rate in the range of 30% of the population in some areas that were affected. That's beyond belief, even in earthquakes, that you have kill rates of, at worst, 5%, 7%. That was that bad. You know what would be worse now? Because we have these giant cities like Chicago and Missouri, we have something else. The heartland of the country is right where all the gas and oil lines go through from the coast to the coast. So if it broke, all those would snap. And so the cool part is we die very quickly, you know, medium rare. But it happens so rarely that if you're insuring earthquakes in this part of the country, you wouldn't want your payoff back in even a lifetime. So you would want to lend on huge, long-term projects. Great story would be as far as skyscrapers falling. I mean, it's an incredibly low probability event. So when something like a giant skyscraper in New York is insured, the insurance companies want to take the premiums and invest them for extremely long periods of time. Okay? Well, the story goes, of course, that on that awful day in September of 2001, three towers, were brought down in New York City. The two main towers, World Trade Towers, one was brought down and then the other was brought down. The truth of the matter is that only one of the two skyscrapers was insured. The probability of one of those skyscrapers ever falling was extremely low. Why would you insure both of them coming down if the probability of one of them coming down was ridiculously low? Two of them coming down? Nah, couldn't happen. Well, it did. Okay. So, we have timing. And finally, okay, let me try this. Fine, okay. You look like a wild and crazy kind of guy. Actually, no, you're not. You're conservative as hell. Most people actually are, even young people. Young people are actually surprisingly conservative. When you try to introduce them to something, yeah, they'll look, might be right for some, but it ain't for the Bufords. I mean, have you ever known someone who was just a totally crazy mofo? I've known people like that. You know, you get in the car, and then you see your dead relatives, as he says, hang on. I've been in that situation. Outrunning a highway patrolman, as I recall. Crazy ass anyway. Okay, now, you see, those kind of people are not common, but they are out there. Different people have different levels of risk, okay? And it is that level of risk that drives the investment decisions. If you prefer a lot of risk, you're going to go for risky investments, because risk comes with an expectation that you're going to get something out of that higher risk. You'd be stupid to do something for nothing, but if you are going to get a good reward for it, there are people who would say, hell yeah, I'll take that risk for that money. And other people, even if the money's good, no. Have you ever been bungee jumping? No. You ever done it? Would you ever do it? No. I'll tell you something, I did it. They don't tell you something about bungee jumping. You know when that bungee jumping cord grabs? It grabs your skeleton. The other parts of you, you know, all the meat, it keeps going. I wasn't sure if it was going to stay attached. I thank God for my skin. Okay, so you see, there are some people who will do things like that. You know, there are people who won't. They're investors. Large-scale investors who will walk right into the lion's den and put their money down. And then there are other people, they probably wouldn't even go near a squirrel fight. Okay? I saw the weirdest ass bumper sticker today. All it said was, got squirrel? What? Anyway, okay. You guys have been all over the prairie too long. Okay, risk. We have to be able to match in terms of level, timing, and risk. That's financial intermediation. It's not, financial institutions are not the only ways it happens. So if I ask this on an exam, hint, if I ask this on an exam, what do you suppose that means? Not probably. Yes, you got it, Sparky. You don't even look like a Sparky. What the hell is that name all about? Okay, anyway. You see, the thing, though, is that it isn't just banks or financial institutions. There are all kinds of financial intermediaries out there. There are even individuals that hook people up with money with people who need money. There are all kinds of ways that it can happen. So don't say, well, financial institutions are financial intermediaries. Not necessarily. There are a lot, and that's one of the things about the creative world that we've got coming on. And if you take other courses from me, I'll talk about some of the great ways that we're beginning to get around these institutions as the financial intermediaries. For example, micro-lending. We couldn't get that stuff going with banks. They sat there in their suits. You want to lend money so some broom maker in Nigeria can make brooms? Ha, ha, ha. Yes, you asshole. He can make money off it. Not much, but you put together 1 million loans like that. Yeah, you'll have a default rate, even if the default rate is 10% on them. You lend money, little pockets of money, there you go. You can make an incredible investment. Banks wouldn't do it. They didn't want anything to do with it. So other organizations, NGOs, non-government organizations, corporations, they got into it. eBay is into this big time. So are some of the other companies. Microlending. That's another way. See, what I'm trying to get at here is don't say financial intermediation is through financial institutions. No, probably the new world that's coming, we're going to have to set those kinds of old-fashioned, unable to adjust and adapt into it totally for themselves, even if it sends the world to hell. We're going to have to put those to the side. We'll still use them. We'll still need them, but not for a lot of the things that are going to drive the 21st century. If you want freedom, you are going to probably have to find some ways around the institutions that don't understand that word. Okay, that is the financial intermediation. And that gives you a sort of a window into what you'll learn in this class. First of all, you're going to learn about project evaluation, financing methods. You're going to learn about the ways that that can happen, both institutionally and through alternative markets. And then you're also going to learn about investing. How do you invest? What are the rules? What's the logic? Can you just listen to someone on some TV show, financial news network show, and believe that person? By the way, the answer to that is under no circumstances should you. You can do it for yourself if you just take my course. Thank God you've got the best professor that ever lived. You've already learned about financial intermediation. You've learned about the big, big deals in finance. Amounts of money, the timings of money, and the risk of the money. Those are the big ones right here. I'm telling you the first day, so you can all go home. You don't have to come back to class. No, yes, you do. Okay, now let's get down to a couple of things. The remainder of this lecture is where I show you the fangs of finance. It is an economics field, and as such, there is a conservative cruelty in the way we think. Some people take it to this extreme where they turn into Tea Party members, and they turn into the kind of people, kill them all, let God sort them out, and all that kind of stuff. That's not finance, and most reasonable people in finance, other than a few extremely rich people who think they got rich because of their brains instead of luck, say the hard things, say the nasty things. But in finance, we are conservative. We have to look at the world in a rational kind of way. And part of that has to do with what constitutes the nature of cost in economics. And that flows into finance. This is at the heart of why we can't take accounting statements at face value. Accounting is historical cost. Historical cost is history. That's the way accounting has to do it. They have to have documents. Do you know, woman, that you could be having a job right now instead of being in this class? You could be making $8 an hour doing something besides being in this class. But instead, no, you're going to be in this class. 3 long hours a week in my class, you should be studying at least 2 hours outside of class for every hour in class. So that means 9 hours a week for 16 weeks. Mind you, woman, what is it? What's 16 times 9? Oh, I can't do math worth a damn. What is it? I don't know. Don't guess at me. You tell me a number, I say it, then you tell me I'm wrong. What is it, 144 hours? Let's say it's $10 an hour. Your opportunity cost, the cost of the best foregone consumption, is $1,440 for this one sad class. Oftentimes, the cost of that is hidden, the money that doesn't come into your pocket, is more than the money that goes out. So when we talk about cost in finance, we talk about it like it is in economics. Full cost. The direct cost and the opportunity cost together. Opportunity cost drives decision making. You don't believe me? Let's talk about where you are going to go and shop based on where you work. We have several different kinds of stores here in town. We got high-end and low-end. If you have been around the town, know the town, we've got a higher-end store like Schnucks. The prices are higher there. Okay, we got a low-end store like Aldi's. I don't shop at Aldi's. I hate Aldi's. They make you pay for your shopping cart. And they throw the food on the floor. But, okay. Well, let's do this. Okay, you have gotten a job at State Barn. You're making $50 an hour. You spun out. You ended up working at the Jiffy Lube, wearing a Jiffy Lube costume, waving people into the store. And you make $10 per hour. The prices are higher at Schnucks. So, you know, you go to Schnucks, there's no one in the line. You get your stuff, you get right out. Let's say it takes you hardly any amount of time at all standing in the line at Schnucks. So, it costs you zero waiting time at Schnucks, zero waiting time at Walmart for both of you. Schnucks, very high prices, but no waiting. Now let's talk about Walmart. First, you have to find parking. You find parking in another county. Then you try to walk to the store. You almost get run over by some prairie hillbilly with a truck that has a bumper sticker that says, "My wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never." Then you walk through the doors, and the first thing you hear is, "Hi, welcome to Walmart." You look, oh, Jesus, it's a midget they got for a greeter. And then you walk down the aisle, there is some cow standing up. "Honey, what do you want for dinner?" "Get out of the way." "Honey, get out of the way, I say. Here's the taser, try that." Whoops, smell fat cooking. Now, you go through, you have to find your food in aisle after aisle, and then you get up to the register, and you are in a line that goes out the door. And inevitably, right in front of you is a family with a bunch of snot-nosed kids, one sitting in the cart with a finger in his nose looking at you. Up at the front of the line is Granny trying to find change in her purse. "I got some pennies in here." "Hurry up, Granny, you're going to die. Don't you want to die at home?" 30 minutes in that line, a half an hour. For a $10 an hour worker, that's only a $5 surcharge. But if you work at State Bar for $50 an hour, suddenly that's a $25 wait time. Opportunity cost has gone, is much higher for the rich person. The rich person would pay as much as $20 more for the pleasure of going to Schnucks. That's how powerful the idea of opportunity cost is. Have you ever been to Disney World and seen the lines down there waiting for the rides? I ran with a very rich crowd of finance jockeys back in the late 90s. We just paid the money and they cut us in lines. They pulled us right to the front of the lines and we got through. Rich people don't stand in the lines. They'll pay not to stand in the lines. Poor people, sure. A kid who has no job, he's going to sit eating Cheetos playing World of Warcraft until the cows come home. But when you're making a lot of money, you're very likely not going to do that kind of stuff. The same is true for breaking the law. A kid who makes very little money, he'll spend 5 years in jail. The opportunity cost is low. But when you're making a lot of money, you don't have time to be some hard-timer's old lady at a federal facility. 5 years is an extraordinarily larger amount of opportunity cost for you. So that's why we have to think in finance in terms of opportunity cost. Well, let's look at this project that you want to do. Where's the land cost? Well, we don't need to include land costs because we own the land. Oh, you own the land. Well, couldn't you sell it or use it for something else? Well, yeah. So it's a cost of this project even if you own it. Well, I never thought of it that. Well, try to next time. Well, we've already got this guy. We're going to move him from this project over to this project. So there's no cost for that salary. Well, yes, there is, because you've given him up over there. What did he cost over there? What was his salary? Well, $80,000, so he's $80,000 cost of this project. But we're not paying anymore, but you're giving up what he did over there. Well, why are you using $80,000? Because that was his value over there. You paid him that, so that's the best estimate I have of it. You see how we think in economic terms in finance. The accounting statements can't do that. Now let's talk about expectations. Expectations matter. They matter in business everywhere. In marketing, you market to create expectations. You don't market the reality of a product. You market an expectation of what that product will do. Claritin will make you float through fields in slow motion. Oil of Olay, you will use that because if you don't use it, you're going to get old and wrinkled and you'll die alone, an old woman, and no one will love you except your poodle who will eat you. Because no one comes to visit an ugly old woman. Prozac, you got to use it, man. It'll make you feel better. It really will. You don't believe me? Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. You understand what we do to you? We create expectations. And in finance, expectations drive our decision making. We need to know what the future is, not what the past is. The past is irrelevant. The past has been eaten by the Langoliers in Stephen King's novel of that title. You see, let me try it this way. You're 35 years old. You married the woman of your dreams 15 years before that. You've had a great life together. Every night you come home. She comes home from work, and the lights are on, candles are in the rooms, your favorite songs are playing, Barry Manilow, Barry White. And it's just been wonderful. Every night of your life you've come home. But then there's this night when you come in the door and it's dark. Honey? Suddenly, from around the edge, she shows up. She's a zombie. And she's a zombie with an Ootsie. And she's fired. And you almost get killed. You slam the door. You run out to your car. You drive away. The rain is coming down. You slow down as you go onto the parkway entrance. And you the radio is playing, oh God, it's playing your song with her. You are so beautiful to me. And the tears are coming down your eyes. Can't you see? You're going to go back home? You had what? 10,000 nights of happiness? One night? What the hell? What'd she fire? She flipped a clip of 20 rounds? Divide that by, you know, 15 years? That's only less than a round a night. Does history matter, or does your expectation of what's going to happen matter when you go back there? So you're not going to go back there, regardless of that wonderful history, regardless of the fact that it gets to the part, to me, not going back. Hell no, not without cardio and the double tap. You see, expectations drive our decision making. Let's go and do one. A little bit of math here. You've gotten your degree here. You've gotten your degree here. And it's a good degree. You change your major to finance. You want to become like me, ugly and bitter. And so you've got your degree. You got a 4-point. And you come to my office and you say, Professor C, I've made my decision on what I'm going to do. Oh, great. You're going to work for one of those companies that I took you guys up to in Chicago? Oh, no. I'm going to start my own little gas station. My dream has always been to have a little kiosk where I can sell gas. I bought a black and white little TV, and I changed my name to Ed so I can wear a shirt that has Ed. And I'm wearing pants that show my crack when I sit down. I want to own my own little gas station. And I just look at you and say, dude, so there you are in your gas station. One of the independents delivers gas to your station and to other stations around the area. Let's say Cocaline comes in. They sell you 10,000 gallons of gas at $3 a gallon. You pull a markup 25 cents a gallon on the gas. So you're selling at 325, which is about what everyone else is around you. Highly competitive markets, you don't have a lot of room to move your price. 325 is prevailing at the gas stations around you. You can get enough, all you get enough business this way. Okay? So the Cocaline driver has just finished selling you your 10,000 gallons of gas, and you paid him the money right there at spot. You paid spot for it, like everyone does in the area. And then you wave at him, and then you go back in to your sad, sad little kiosk, and you sit down at your chair to watch the TV. Now, you watch, of course, news, because you're really into news. And obviously you watch Fox News, because you're into news that really isn't news. And you sit there, and you notice, wait, where's my talk show? Where the hell's my talk show? It's not there. It's not there. Instead, there are images of things blowing up, of fire, of explosions, of ships sinking, of a jet coming across the sky, and then you see a mushroom cloud. Image. What the hell? I'm going to turn it to something else. You keep turning it, and these images are on every channel. Finally, you decide you're going to have to read what's saying at the bottom. Israel attacks Iran. Nuclear weapons used in bunker busters, facilities in Qom and several other places are reported breached. Iran responded. It has already sunk one U.S. aircraft carrier in the Gulf. Three super tankers of oil are burning in the Strait of Hormuz. A battleship group has begun counter operations, taking out the coastal batteries. Silkworm missiles have already been reported to be downing ships of various flags. By the time the Cocaline driver gets to the next station, he's already got Spot. Spot has gone to $9. So you've got these other cats that are paying $9. They've marked up 25. So every other station around you is now selling at 925 because they paid Spot at 9. What are you going to do to your price? Why, you greedy capitalist son of a bitch? Why are you going to raise your price? You bought it at $3 a gallon, you running capitalist dog. Why?
Because you can.
No. Actually, that's not the answer. Now, you see, you could be the kind, I'm going to charge more. I bought it at $3. My customers love me. I'm going to sell it to them at $3.25. Uh-huh. That's my job. Uh-huh. I can be very friendly. Yes, I can. My customer loved me. Okay. What are you going to do when the Coca-Cola driver comes back around to sell you your next load when you sold your gas at $3.25 a gallon? You won't have the money to buy the next load of gasoline. You just won't have that money available to you. You see, it does not matter what the historical cost was. What matters is the expected replacement cost. That's the only thing that matters. Because you know what's going to happen? If you sell your gas at $3.25, what will customers do as they go by your station? They'll buy your gas. They'll buy every drop you have, and then when you have not enough money to buy another load of gas, you know what they'll do? They'll just drive to the next station. They won't even shed a tear that you're out of business because they don't give a rat's ass. All they're going to do is bitch about the price of gasoline. They don't care that you tried to do something you thought was the right thing. All they care about is where the hell they can get their next tank full of gas. See, that's how it's going to work. Sounds like you don't care. Well, guess what? They don't care a lot more than you don't care. You see, if you charge at the prevailing, based upon expected replacement cost, you'll be in business for the next round where you might be able to care. But if you don't sell at expected replacement, you aren't going to be there to care. You see, and we're all care bearers at our heart. Okay, now, last round on this. Expectations drive our decision making. Not what did happen, not what might have happened in the past, but what we think, our best estimate of what is going to happen. In investments, I've run into this before so many times. You have a person who bought $100 worth of stock. The stock has collapsed in value. Now his portfolio is worth $10. Well, what are you going to do now that your stock has dropped in price? Wrong answer. I'm going to hold on to it until it gets back to $100. That's a completely wrong answer. You see, because there is no $100. Well, yes, there is. It's right in that stock. I thought you said that stock was worth $10. Well, it is now, but I paid $100. You know where that $100 is? Let me see if I can get this right to you. Do you know where that $100 is? It's with Jesus. It's gone to heaven, and it's sitting right at the right hand of the Lord. It is not on this earth anywhere. There is no $100 anymore. That's just a memory. Okay? It's gone forever. It won't come back, unlike ex-wives. It won't come back. It's not ever going to be seen again. You see, the problem is that people think that $100 is somewhere. It's not. Whether you buy, hold, or sell will be based upon the value from the $10, not from the $100. You understand what that means? Case studies. Let's try one. There was a certain famous fast food restaurant, years ago, that decided that it was going to get into the business of selling pizzas, personal size and family size pizzas. Now, does anyone know what a restaurant chain did this? Say it.
No, Little Caesars was always a pizza place. This was actually fast food burgers and fries.
McDonald's. They were in the pizza business.
They piloted them in several major markets, found out their pizzas were damn good. I'm not kidding, they were delicious. But there was something interesting, of course. To do this on a large scale, they were going to have to put in ovens in every one of their restaurants. Some of these companies actually have threatened to sue me when I tell the cases. But in this case, they moved ovens in. They got everything going. And I think their target, and I could be wrong about this, I think their target was 75% of their franchises and store-owned would have these pizza ovens and be able to sell personal and family-sized pizzas. They went full blast. Now, where they did their tests were in big, big walk-in types of their facilities. And it was a big hit. Families loved them for for birthday parties. People liked getting these pizzas to take home and all this kind of stuff. But mainly it was walk-in. Then when they got to the point where they were actually making the pizzas, two things came very evident in the first round of stores they put them in, close to 250, I think it was. Well, here's the first thing, is that when you order, they wanted them fresh. So when they ordered one of these pizzas, it had to be made and baked. That took at least 9 minutes. Drive-through, that's a disaster. 9 minutes in a drive-through is not going to happen. So they were having people pull up and wait for their pizzas. So they finally got it down so that they got a good routine. They had pizzas online so that they could give them right to the customers through the drive-through. Worked better, except that the pizza boxes didn't fit through the drive-through windows. Not even sideways. So there were some stories of these people at the drive-through window. They would just chop the pizza down the middle and here's your damn pizza. But this meant that the company was going to have to rebuild the drive-through windows of every one of these restaurants that had these ovens in them. Every one of them. That's a major capital decision. You're basically taking out one wall outside to in of your building. Well, what happened was this. The decision making on whether to do it or not came down to, we've already spent all this money on the ovens, on the R&D, on the test markets. So we have to go forward. You know what the right answer to that would have been? Baloney! No, you don't have to go forward. You're crazy. That money is already spent. It has nothing whatsoever to do with your decision here and now for a capital expenditure of staggering size compared to the ovens. You should be asking yourself, how much revenue are you going to make based upon what you're about to invest? Not what you've already invested, but what you're about to invest. They didn't do it that way. Now let me ask you this. Does Mickey D's have pizzas anymore? No. Because it turned out we finance people were right. It turned into one of those projects that we, in technical terms, we say it sucked. You might want to write that down. This technical stuff is pretty tough. That's all I have for you. Go home.